Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guests this week, Marnie Hare-Bickle. Each week we visit with a local author, editor, songwriter, teacher, or someone otherwise involved with the world of words. We hope to find out a little about her life, what prompts her to write, give her an opportunity to read some of her work for us, and we're very pleased to have Marnie Bickle pay us a return visit today. Welcome, Marnie.
Thank you.
Marnie Hare-Bickle has been fascinated by words and music for as long as she can remember. She studied piano and voice and taught herself to play the guitar so that she could perform her own songs at school, church, and community events. She wrote her first poem for her parents when she was 8 years old. Her work in early childhood education sparked her interest in children's literature, and she used her own poems and songs for teaching. She's written many articles about Canadian musicians and composers, and opera and the University of Toronto, which chronicles the second 25 years of the school for its 50th anniversary. She still runs a music studio with over 20 students in Port Hope, but that hasn't stopped her from editing the memoirs of John David Ford, a relative of her husband's, whose long-forgotten memoirs were found in the attic of her home. It's been 3 years since Marnie was here to tell us about finding a treasure trove of John Ford's papers in their attic. And now her book is about to be released by Blue Denim Press. Congratulations, Marnie.
Thank you.
First, Marnie, remind us of how you discovered the treasure in your attic. Did the collection sometimes seem to be more of a burden than a treasure?
Mm-hmm. Well, we bought the home and property in Canton that belonged to my husband's relative, Ruth Hawkins Ford, and her husband, John David Ford. They met through a war effort. David's commanding officer wrote his wife and asked if she would have some of the young single women in Port Hope and Cobourg write to his unmarried soldiers to keep up their morale. Ruth drew Dave's name, and she wrote to him faithfully for almost 5 years. And after the war, he asked her by letter if she would marry him. And so instead of going to the Arctic, back to the Arctic, he came to Port Hope, married her. They built their home in Canton and lived there the rest of their married lives.
David had been brought up in the Arctic.
That's right.
Right.
Yes, he was. So by the time Ruth was 91, she'd been a widow for 16 years. She decided she needed a retirement home, and we were looking for a new home. So the deal was we could buy her house if we packed everything up for her. And so we did that, but we left the attic until last. So it was a bit of a dog's breakfast. Boxes and boxes of letters and manuscripts and these orange school exercise books that they were all written in pencil, cover to cover. And those were David's original manuscripts that he wrote while he was still in the Arctic. So other things like unfinished paintings and hooked rugs and sewing projects and slides, box after box of slides depicting their lives together. I'd not ever met Dave. I'd only heard about him through the family. And he was always described as a character, a fun-loving guy with all these tall tales of the Arctic. Kids couldn't get enough of the tales, but the adults took them with a grain of salt. So I think the burden was to be able to take these wonderful manuscripts and validate that these tall tales that they thought he was telling, they weren't fiction, they were true.
How long did it take for you to realize what an important collection of papers you'd found?
I think really once I started reading the manuscripts. I started with the letters. These were the letters that David had written to Ruth during the war. I only had his letters. I would love it if I'd had hers as well. But I had 276 letters written from the time they started to be pen pals until the end of the war. So I put them in order and then started making notes. The letters were fine, but it led me to think that I really wanted to know more about Dave's beginnings, about his early life in the Arctic. So that's when I sorted the manuscripts and found out that I had his original written in pencil booklets with all his memories in, and some of them I had typed copies or a number of typed copies of manuscripts that he was trying to get published. So I started reading those, and I was hooked after that.
Mm-hmm. So doing research, did you do sort of research on the Arctic and the setting generally, on to fit David Ford into his stories?
Something that I didn't understand or hadn't sort of learned about previously, I really did take the time to look everything up and validate that, yes, this really either could happen or did happen. Certain pieces of equipment, I didn't understand what that was, so I would research that, get books from the library or go online to research, mostly so that I could then take what he'd written and simplify the description so that anybody could understand what he was talking about.
World War II changed David, didn't it? And he never really got back to the Arctic as he wanted to. Were you tempted to write a biography of him?
The war did change him. When he returned to Canada, the doctors told him that he should not go back to the Arctic, back to that solitary life of a trapper trader. He really needed to be with people. Did he know anybody in southern Canada? Well, he'd already asked Ruth to marry him. I'm not sure her parents knew that, but they had done that by letter. So, yeah.
So they'd never met.
They'd never met.
And they didn't really know what each other looked like.
They had sent one another a picture, but that's it. They had no other way of knowing each other other than by letter.
Well, that was brave of Ruth, wasn't it?
Yes. To agree. Almost like carrying on her war duty a little bit further.
Yes, and she'd stayed in the same place, in her own place.
Yes.
He was
right there. So, yes, the war changed him. I would love to write a biography of him, but I'm not sure I have enough information. But I have some other ideas, so their life post-war will figure into some other project that I have in mind.
Okay. Well, how about reading to us from one of David's memoirs or from the introduction to your book, if you prefer?
I'm going to read to you from Coats Island. They're going on an egg hunting expedition. Don't forget, in the Arctic, they really live on a lot of meat. So to have the opportunity to change up their diet a bit, the elders had told them about this huge colony of murres. So murres are similar to penguins, relatives of the penguin family. So they go to this colony, and they've figured out how they're going to get down the side of the cliff to collect these eggs. So this is a little excerpt from that. When we reached the top, we got down on our stomachs and cautiously peered over the dizzying, slippery edge. The overhang hid most of the birds. We busied ourselves with our skin lines, ropes, and harnesses to prepare to take turns rappelling down the cliff. The signal cord was light, as there was to be no weight attached to it. The signals were simple. One jerk for down, two jerks for up, three jerks meant stop. "Who wants to go first?" I asked. Nobody answered. "Pizio?" No. "Koal?" No. "Kunga?" No, I'm too heavy. Pizio said, "You go first. You're the lightest one of the group." All eyes were on me. I was the youngest and lightest, so had the honor of going first. I slipped my legs into a harness, and several straps were fastened with many knots below my armpits. I walked backwards to the brink of nothingness as bravely as I could, then got down on hands and knees and crawled backwards. For a moment I hesitated. I inched my body over the jagged edge and hung in space. The rope was let out slowly, and I went down, down, out of sight. I was alone. My nearest neighbors were the noisy murres eyeing me curiously as I swung on the end of the rope. I looked down to the base of the rookery. The pans of ice looked like small white buttons. As I swung to and fro in my skin-lined harness, the murres cocked their heads to see me. At first, all was quiet. You could hear them say, "Man or beast?" A lone male, a safe distance from me, screeched defiantly. He had no reason to challenge me. He was on a firm ledge, me in midair. Immediately, the rest of the colony started up a deafening chorus, and bedlam broke out. Some nesting birds flew off. One looked as though it might peck me. I was armed with a small stick tied to my wrist for just such an emergency. The strong, thin rope was cutting into my flesh. I signaled to be lowered. As I descended, I gathered the eggs that were within my reach and put them into a sack tied to my hip. I needed to rest again. My toes found a ledge, and I tugged three times on the signal rope and came to a stop. This ledge was slimy and slippery. I hardly breathed. Muirs had now settled above me again. The sack at my side was getting heavy with eggs. Some birds, in their haste to take off from their perches, dislodged their lone egg that came hurtling down. I was splattered from head to foot with egg juice and guano. As I rested, I could see thousands of muirs far below me in places that would be impossible to reach. I was tiring and losing my nerve. A cold sweat dripped from my brow to my chin. I wondered if I would ever reach the top of the rookery again. For a brief moment, I closed my eyes until I regained my composure, trying to forget the dizzying height. Finally, I pulled twice on the signal cord, and a second later my harness tightened and I was pulled up from my resting place. I was bumped, scratched, and spun around while dangling in space. Up, up, with hands and feet, I warded off protruding edges, helping the boys above me with the toehold whenever I could. My skin-line harness caught in the loose rocks, and they went whizzing down the sheer drop to the ice below. I watched with horror as the rope rubbed against the razor-sharp edge of a rock above me, out of my reach. A strand broke. I kicked against the cliff to get the frayed rope away from the jagged edge. "Oh, mercy, have mercy," I whispered. The ropes cut into me more than ever since my weight had been increased by the sack of pale blue and green spotted eggs. I tried to get a toehold. My foot slipped and I dangled in midair. Would the rope break or would the two remaining strands hold? A large jeer falcon on patrol around the cliff sailed past me, beating its pointed wings. It swooped up and came to rest on a ledge, eyeing me suspiciously. I was about to use my knife to cut loose the bag of eggs, but that was not necessary. At last, I saw the overhanging top of the rookery. I reached up and was pulled to safety by strong arms. I rolled over on my back and saw the smiling faces of my friends. My face and hands were scratched, my clothes torn, my throat dry, but I was safe.
Thank you, Marnie. That was really exciting. It was, you described that all very well.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Now we'll take a short break.